All right, it's taking it down, son of a bitch. We're still alive for episode 10. How have we done it?
Still kicking.
Yeah. Episode 10. Not by being the best, because frankly, we're the second best. We're a pop culture podcast brought to you by the Alabama Take. I am the host, Blaine Duncan. Here's what I do. I have on guests. We talk about TV, music, movies, other podcasts, books. We sort through how we feel and why we feel it. Think of it as your every other week therapy session, except a little less expensive, I think. And we don't talk about you because we love you, okay? So we're coming at you on the day of a big, big release. Disney Plus is out today, and we certainly plan into getting into those shows in a couple of weeks. But for this episode, we're all about HBO, the show Watchmen. Adam Morrow and I are going to try to dissect some of that density. And then in the back half of the episode, I'm going to have on Kevin Halbrook, and he and I are going to be conversing over some of the happenings of late in and around Tuscaloosa's oldest and probably most famous dive bars, Egan's. Talk through that shit. All right, let's get into it. Okay, we are welcoming Adam Morrow. He's been busy AF with making music on the road. But you've managed to sneak in some time in the last couple of weeks for the HBO show Watchmen. Before we get into that, I really want to. I mentioned it in the intro. You and the wife planning on getting Disney Plus? You going to get a little of that action?
We hadn't talked about it yet. I got to do some digging. I know that there's some Star Wars stuff coming down the line. Immediate action.
Dude,
what's going
on? The Mandalorian. You're not going to watch that?
No, we'll figure it out. We'll figure it out.
Have you seen the trailer for The Mandalorian?
I haven't.
Really?
No.
Okay, so I'll say this.
You could just be making up a word right now, for all I know.
I kind of am. No, I'm not. I'm not. I had my doubts. I kept my finger to the pulse of Disney Plus, and I had my doubts. I thought, I'm talking about 6-7 months ago, I had my doubts, and I was like, one more streaming service? Probably not. Okay, whatever. Then they came out with the price, $7.99.
That's not bad.
Not bad. Then they came out with the Mandalorian trailer, and it looks as good, if not better, than the movies. I was very impressed. It looks like a Star Wars movie, except over the course of 8 or 10 episodes or however many. And they're going to release them once a week. I like that. And
I do like that model of streaming. Yeah.
Catalog. I do too.
That's pretty amazing. And they own basically everything.
Yeah.
Yeah, that it gives it some of the ability to do what we're about to do with Watchmen, which is, I'm glad that I can't watch all, was it 9 of these episodes?
Is it going
to
be 9?
In a row? It's 9 total. And I feel like I need the breather here in between. So
no shit.
Kudos
it's
to them. It is.
All right. Well, let's get into Watchmen. And before we do, just a quick recap. I'm going to rattle it off. The HBO show is almost half sequel, half reimagining, probably more sequel, of the 1986 comic by Alan Moore and Dave Gibbons. It's set around 38, 39 years past that comic's date, so when the comic ends, fast forward 39 years, give or take. The comic itself was set in a different America than what we're in right now. It had masked vigilantes fighting some crime, with only one of them turning out to have any powers at all, and that's Dr. Manhattan. He kind of got his powers through a atomic accident, sort of. The show itself has Regina King as Sister Knight. It's got Don Johnson as her kind of boss. He's police chief named Judd Crawford.
It's got
Judd Crawford. Got yeah. Tim Blake Nelson as another police detective in a mask who goes by Looking Glass. Almost all the show takes place in 2019, Oklahoma. It's an Oklahoma where Robert Redford is not only the president of the United States, but also as a follow-up to Nixon. So Nixon got more and more tenure there because of winning the Vietnam War, because of Dr. Manhattan. But Robert Redford's given out reparations, probably not limited to the Black Wall Street Massacre in the 1920s Oklahoma, but maybe nationwide. The show's created and run by Damon Lindelof, who was in charge of the series Lost and the other HBO series, The Leftovers. And I think that brings us up. That's the broad overview.
That's it.
That's the doors open for us. So we're four episodes in. You and I watched episode four last night, and this, if you're listening to this on a week that it's released, four episodes are all we have. And I think last night made a lot of stuff more clearer. Before, I want you to give me a, what's your one word adjective to the show? One, two word adjective, because I've got one.
Well, we've already said dense.
Dense is good.
Dense is definitely there, and I'll take up a little, maybe a little more time here than you intended.
No,
but part of what I'm loving about this show so far is that they assume we're able to make connections without them being obvious.
There
I think there's a certain intelligence that like they're respecting of us as viewers.
Yeah,
where
there's
they
no
don't,
hand-holding.
No, they don't spell anything out. And I'm having a pretty interesting experience with this because when it started, I had not seen the previous movie. I know that that has, there's divided opinion on that.
Yeah.
And more importantly, I hadn't read the graphic novel.
Mm.
So I've fallen so deep into this that we went and got it last week and I'm four chapters in to the graphic novel. So I'm catching up. So you'll have more background knowledge, and maybe I've just confused myself even more by reading just a limited amount of it. Mm. But hey, I'm here. I'm in it.
My word was meticulous.
Meticulous is a great word, too.
That's a good one, yeah. For the show, I'm not bragging on myself. I'm saying that's a good one because the show is meticulous. It's, if you're not watching it, well, no. I want to come to you with this one since you brought it up. What has reading the comic made clear for you?
I think that the atmosphere, Lindelof's done a great job mirroring the vibe of the source material, I guess. You know, it's a little, we kind of had a conversation of, is this dystopian or is it just like kind of an alternate reality? Like, what's going on here? And it feels all of those things kind of ominous. You know, the tone is definitely there. And it goes hand in hand with the original work. But reading has also given me this whole background of, you know, how that America that the HBO show is living in, how that all was set up. And it's kind of a strange way to approach a work of fiction that means so much to so many people. It's kind of like the Old Testament to this thing that I'm watching now. So it's been cool to see how it goes hand in hand.
Good analogy. I think the comic may have even had a better, you're talking about the vibe of the comic and the show being so similar. I think the comic may have had more of a tone of oncoming, ominous, you said ominous, this oncoming apocalyptic feeling. I think the comic has
TikTok,
that.
TikTok.
Oh man, doesn't it have that? So, well, the show feels a little bit more dramatic than ominous, which is fine. That's not a knock against the show at all.
Well, and I think that episode four is maybe the first time that the scope of things is bringing on that ominous feeling.
Yeah.
Before, it was kind of just more dramatic, and you have these micro issues, which they're big issues, like the 7th Cavalry being back. You know, working as a white supremacist group in Tulsa and causing all these problems. And then you kind of zoom out a little bit more and the FBI is getting involved and you zoom out even further. And, you know, there's this mad scientist kind of guy who is slowly identified doing his thing, his experiments. And then you have now this mother and daughter building the clock, which I want to talk about that later. There's some interesting things going on there. I think episode four brought a lot of stuff together.
Yes, it did. I think we'll use episode four as our pinpoint because it is a little clearer than the first three. It's a measured show on what it wants to reveal, but it has not reached any sort of point of frustration. And I was curious if you found it any frustrating having not read the comic or seen that movie before.
No, I didn't feel that way at all. I felt that, like you said, they're revealing information at a good clip, you know, like I'm able to move through the story and have a sense of these characters, even without maybe the background or how they all fit together.
this show works really well as a comparison piece for Westworld, which it wants to be measured, but it's frustrating. And it comes off as just trying to be really clever, whereas Watchmen holds its cards close to its chest, but does a good job of helping you feel not too lost.
Right.
You're thinking, but you're not lost. And if you'd never read the comics, I'm just really curious if you would throw your hands up in the air and say, you know, fuck this, I'm not watching this show.
No, I don't think so. I think, you know, there were reveals maybe that had to be explained. I mean, like the early on when who we now know as Adrian Ozymandias was doing his play recreation, you know, of the creation of Dr. Manhattan. I didn't know what was going on there.
Oh, and, yeah. What did you think then? If you didn't know what was going on, did you think, why is this guy naked and blue?
I knew enough of the background to know that it had to do with the creation of the superhero. The one true, like you said earlier, the one with actual powers. But it works just as well as a demonstration of this guy's cruelty.
Yes, you know? Yeah, yeah.
So you get a glimpse into his psychology, but it's also about him burning this. And it's one of the first times you realize when the rest of the servants, or whatever he calls them, come to collect this charred body, that they're all clones. Yeah. They're the same guy and girl.
Yeah. I'd seen it speculated if they were robots or clones, but I think last night's episode, episode 4, made it clear that they're clones.
Disturbingly clear that they are definitely clones.
Wow. This is a show that has its own website that fills in some of the blanks between the comic. It's created, I'm using air quotes, created by one of its characters, an FBI agent helping to investigate the death of a primary character. That happens early in episode 1. If you're this far, you know.
That's a fun way, as I'm going through the comic and realizing that there are multiple sources for the story. You know, you have they'll go into pretty great detail about comics that people are reading in the background of the comic, or people writing autobiographies, all these different, this mixed way of delivering the story, and that they're doing it in almost like a meta fiction way. Yeah, with the website. That's interesting.
The website's called PDpedia, PD with a Y. I haven't been to. I visited once. Have you been to the website?
I haven't. I didn't know that existed. PD being the FBI agent, right? Who kind of has a respectful crush on basically everybody involved. There seems to be kind of happy to be there. Maybe they'll flip that eventually, but
yeah. He's a historian on the show, and at some point creates a website, or maybe is creating it as the show's ongoing. But I have relied on reviewers and recappers to kind of fill in some of those blanks that they get from the PDpedia. I don't think it's mandatory that you read that. This is not one of those shows that you don't have to go down a Reddit search in order to understand everything. But
I mean, it lends itself to that for sure.
Yeah, it does. So this Watchmen is a story entrenched in race and race relations. What strikes you the most about that thematic element of the race?
The open with the Tulsa race massacre, the Black Wall Street massacre in 1921, I thought was, after that aired that Sunday night, Monday morning, I just, Twitter and Facebook, just were littered with articles about, curious about, you know, what went on HBO last night. Here's the actual history of it. I think we've all talked about how this is a thing that, you know, so many people died, so much property was destroyed. And it's something that Americans did to Americans, white Americans did to Black Americans. And it's just kind of skipped over in our history classes, which is, I'm not surprising in a sad way, but there's been a lot of deep dives on that, which I think plays well into the show, where kind of piecing together pieces of history, be they family or societal, is a huge deal. And I think last night on episode four, one of the things that I immediately wrote down when I was thinking about we have this podcast to do is the idea of inherited trauma between generations and how that seems to be the driving element of the show. You have Will, the wheelchair-bound character that we meet in the first episode, who keeps, through the episodes, claiming to have killed the chief, Chief Crawford, and reveals him to be a former KKK member, or, you know, there's something fishy going on with that robe in the secret compartment. And as he tries to reconnect with his granddaughter, Angela, that's going on. And then mirroring that, Lady True trying to share her experience chemically, it seems. And I think this ties into the pills that Will gives Angela. Lady True somehow has hooked her daughter up to an IV at night, and it seems like she's trying to transmit memory. And, you know, she...
Is that weird?
I think...
Should I be doing that with my daughter?
I think probably so. Yeah. She needs to... Memories of Sulligent in the 80s and 90s are probably a key part of being a Duncan, I would assume.
Yeah. Or not. Lindelof, the creator, has commented that that race is such a looming presence in America that to do a show without it as a primary source of conflict felt really false. And I don't disagree with that at all. He uses these white supremacists who go by that, you mentioned them, the 7th Cavalry with a K. How fitting is that?
Mm-hmm.
And they have this propensity for the Rorschach mask, who was an original character in the comic, with some serious issues of seeing the world in only black and white. You know, I mean that figuratively, but, you know, perhaps there's some some literal interpretation to that as well. And you're talking about passed down trauma. How do you think that weaves in the idea of people wearing masks?
Well, and that's another interesting point that I think comes up as Laurie Blake, who we haven't talked about yet.
No, she appeared in episode three. She comes in and she's a comic character.
Right. And she, through her position as the kind of ironically now, her job is to hunt down these vigilantes. She confronts Angela and says, what happened, in more or less words, what happened in your childhood that caused you to wear a mask? You know, usually people with that background, this is her psychological profile as an FBI task force, the head of one, she says there's usually a childhood trauma or injustice, in Angela's case, being an orphan, that causes them to put on the mask to try to exact justice, and also the mask to hide themselves from that earlier pain. Which is interesting, because it's all about something that happened in the past and how it's affecting the present. And there's even some weird time manipulation stuff going on where you kind of wonder who knows what, how it happened, when. I don't know. The levels of this is where we're getting to that. It's meticulous and dense. Back to our two words there.
And that's the appearance of Jean Smart, the actress who plays the comic character. She was Silk Spectre in the comics, but she's now the federal agent you were mentioning, who handles these masked figures because they're not legal. And they weren't legal in the comic either. That was kind of the thing. And Senator Keene, not great Bob.
Not great Bob.
Played by Jim Wolk, I think his name is.
This guy is going to make a career out of playing characters that are unsettling. You know, like Bob, you the whole time you're thinking Bob is going to end up being a serial killer or something in Mad Men. Like something's up with this guy. And now he's back and you immediately assume that he's somehow involved in some great scandal, some conspiracy. Mm-hmm. At least I did.
Yeah, no, I think everybody's onto that at this point. He plays the smarmy sort of artificial... artificially nice guy. But Senator Keene is, I think he plays, is he the, not the son of the Joe Keene Senior, who
from the Keene Act.
There you go. Yeah. There you go. The Keene Act causing masked vigilantes to be illegal in the first place. And he makes mention to help her with this jailed night owl, which was her love interest 39 years ago in the comic. And he says, I can help you get the owl out of the cage. So,
right. Right. And he also, he kind of taunts Angela a bit, or I took it as a, I've seen other commenters say that when he calls her by name while she's wearing the mask,
mm-hmm.
that is there like a little bit of intimidation
Absolutely.
Being attempted there?
Yeah, I think so. And it's probably known to be impolite to do that. Even if you know who it is in a crowd, you wouldn't call them.
Right.
I think I get that that vibe. He's shady. Let's put it like that.
Right.
Hmm. So let's dive into episode 4 as our pin. And we got the opening. It was like a mixed up version of Superman where we have the Clark family. It's a man and wife who can't have any kids. Lady True shows up, tells them, I need your land and I can give you a kid. Probably a clone.
She's the second one with cloning abilities, mm-hmm. it seems.
And then something lands far off, but on their farm, far away. So it's like a mixed up version of Superman.
Which is the whole idea for going in there. You know, when she walks in and she has a binder with these papers that she's trying to get them to sign to buy the land.
Binders of women like Mitt Romney.
Binders of women?
No, I don't think it was binders of women. She's just got a binder, business binder.
She's got a binder.
Yeah.
And she has this, this hourglass that she turns over and tells them they have 3 minutes to make this decision. And she slowly introduces, you know, here's your child. I'm not telling you you can have a child. Here it is right now. Immediate gratification. You also, there's like a kind of sinister subtext of like what's going to happen to the child if they don't take it, all of that. But the fact that she's there 3 minutes before that thing lands, clearly that's what she's counting down to.
Mm-hmm.
When she puts that binder and that hourglass on the table, did you pick up that there was a puzzle underneath it that they had been working on earlier in the evening? So all her entire proposal is made over an unfinished puzzle. And clearly she's trying to like put something together. And so that brings up all these questions to me. Did she know that crash landing was coming somehow?
Oh, yeah.
She kind of treats it as a delivery to her.
Mm-hmm.
So she knew that she had to own that property in order to own whatever that crash land was.
Yeah.
By, you know, whatever time of the evening that was.
Yep.
Which brings in a whole element of like, does she know the future? Is she like a multi? I mean, Dr. Manhattan is kind of shown to exist at all times in this almost godlike way, but also not. You know, how does this stuff work? What's going on?
I don't know if she knows the future as much as she. This is my guess. As much as she knows that was going to happen. And what is that something? You got any guesses on what landed?
It's been ignored since then.
Yeah. Do you have a guess?
I don't. I have no earthly clue what that could be. Although the fact that they later show old Adrian launching the corpses of his servants, he seems to be attempting to get out of some dimension that he's held in.
I get the vibe that he's being held by Dr. Manhattan.
Like in some parallel dimension kind of thing?
Maybe on Mars in some created atmosphere. That's my guess. And he's trying to launch himself out. You know, he put the space suit sort of thing on one of his clones.
And didn't go well.
Didn't go well. And he's apparently been doing this for a while. Now, Ozymandias, this guy, Adrian Veidt, if I'm pronouncing it right, he's the character who dropped a giant squid on New York to try to end the Cold War in the comic. But now he's in a castle. It's an imprisonment of some sort. Very separated from the action of Oklahoma, apparently. And he's really intelligent guy. But, and there's also this horseshoe. You know, he keeps saying, I don't need the horseshoe right now. to his clone slash servant, but now he's launching them into space to try to see, I think, how to get out of this imprisoned thing. Is that him that lands in the beginning of the episode in the backyard of the Clark family?
They've already shown that they're willing to... The storylines don't necessarily have to happen sequentially.
No.
In appearance to us. They've already displayed that with the open this week when Angela is going through the Greenwood Center and comes out and finds Lori standing in front of the car. That's how last week's episode ended.
Right.
So who's to say?
Yeah, Ozymandias, that guy, he's operating on a different timeline, sort of, because don't the cakes he keeps getting represent a year he's been there?
Hmm.
It's possible that that's the case.
But he's, right, so are we, they seem to happen daily, but are we just seeing a whole, is this a fast version, fast presentation of that, that experience? Because he said he's been there for 4 years, right?
That sounds right. So, yeah, we could have that going on. He's operating on a different timeline, or maybe not. I think that'll be resolved probably soon.
I think it was interesting that when the big clock is talked about, that Lady True is building, she first asked the couple before presenting the child, she says, "Do you know who I am?" And they say, "Well, you're Lady True, you're building the big clock." And she says, "It's much more than a big clock."
Mm-hmm.
Later, when her daughter is walking, walking Angela and Lori to the tea that they're going to have with Lady True, they say, "Well, what are you doing here? What is this thing?" And she says, "It tells time." So they've denied that it's a clock, but admitted that it tells time. Mm-hmm. So there's some subtle wordplay difference going on there that, I don't know, maybe that plays right into what you're saying of like an alternate timeline kind of thing.
And Lady True's habitat mirrors Ozymandias, his habitat he had built in Antarctica, almost like she got that idea from him, or he helped her build it, or something like that. And it also makes me think that she's the antagonist, much like he was a big antagonist
right.
in the comics.
I mean, she does have a statue there in the garden.
It's
so
true.
Who knows?
Yeah. And that was Lady True's daughter who was buying up all those newspapers in an episode or two
right.
ago, which that didn't click with me until I read something today. She claims she reads them all. She's hooked to that IV and having nightmares that feel like memories of Vietnam, the Vietnam War. So time is a huge motif in this.
Right. And also the idea of legacy and how that relates to time. I guess you have Lady True giving the couple the child and saying legacy is not land. She's trying to buy the land from him, of course, at this point. So that works in her favor to say that. It's not in land, it's in blood.
Mm.
Which I guess plays right into that idea of they're trying to share memories with successive generations, both Lady True and Will. And also just filling in the gaps of, I read one commenter say, this is the AV Club is doing great work this season.
Yes, they are. Shout out to, what's her name? Monique? That might be your first or last
Joelle
name.
Monique.
Yeah, she's good.
But writing from the perspective of Black America, I guess, or viewing it from that perspective, she just pointed out how moving that scene was where Angela sees the gaps in her family tree filled in.
Yeah.
And all of those people on that family tree had agency, you know, and did great things. And it was kind of heartbreaking to see, I guess, in the scene before that when you see, you're just coming out of Lady True talking about all these things about legacy and they're presented with the kid and those things are fresh on your mind. And you see that letter again that says, "Watch over this boy."
Yeah.
And on the flip side is the, you know, the Germans had tried to get what turns out to be Angela's great grandfather to abandon U.S. forces and flee to Germany during World War One. Angela accidentally sets that on fire.
Right.
So there's all these questions about it. Very muddy, I guess, which it feels like a great American story in that way.
Lots of connective tissue in this. Maybe everything's pretty connected. It's a very thoughtful show. Each episode is pretty much a day. That's also a little detail associated with time I found pretty mm-hmm. cool. And speaking of a luxury, and though these are fictional, you know, Adrian's clones don't have the luxury of time, because let's talk about how disturbing that scene was with him fishing fetuses, babies, out of a lake.
Like a crab trap in a lake, yeah.
Yeah, and throwing away those that didn't seem to have promise, and then taking them, putting them in some sort of machine that ages them instantly. That was pretty harrowing.
Yeah, it was a little tough to watch.
It sold the idea that this guy has no empathy.
I saw a great meme. Somebody had taken a picture of him and just put the "Okay, Boomer" text on it. It's like, yeah, that kind of works. That kind of makes sense.
No empathy, huh?
No, just burning the world around him for his own ends, believing he's doing something for the greater good. Yeah, that works. That checks out.
Yeah.
Logic's there. But he even has a quote that I forgot to write it down, but he's explaining to them why they, basically, that they don't qualify as being alive because they don't have purpose. Mm-hmm. They only exist to serve. Like, they don't have any license or agency. And so that defines how valuable they are, I guess. And that's what he's fighting against, is to get out of whatever this imprisonment is, to get his back. And he doesn't really care how many of these beings he has to sacrifice to get there.
Exactly. And in that same scene, he's got the quote that he's their master, but not their creator.
Right. He doesn't want to have to be their creator.
That's a pretty loaded piece of text from the show.
It is. But then that it brings up the biggest, if you want to get on Reddit and enjoy your conspiracy theories, who is the game warden? What's going on with that? That was a very brief scene, but I feel like that's an important element here.
To me, I haven't read a lot into that one personally. I've just assumed he's a guard of sorts. But you're right, it probably is a character that's going to have more screen time and seem more important in the next few episodes.
Right. That was something that at the time didn't seem as consequential. And now that it's been shown that he's actively trying to escape, like all these experiments are to get him out of there, then the warden's got to factor into that somehow.
You're right. He will. So why do you think it's Oklahoma for the setting? What about Oklahoma did Lindelof think is important? It's alluded to in this episode with the clock being built that it's 1,000 miles from ocean, so it's avoid damage. But that seems, I don't know that that's really here or there on Lindelof's thinking on setting. Is it because of the riots?
I think so.
The massacre?
I mean, that seems a massacre like that at the geographic heart of America seems like a perfect, if you want to tell a story about American cultural memory and, you know, I mean, inherited trauma, that's we've already kind of exhausted that, but people who deny that happens culturally, I don't understand that at all. Like, that's, we deal with it every single day. We have a president who is president because of that. You know what I mean? So to really comment on American society and where we're at, that seems like the perfect place to have these great, very potent symbols.
And I wouldn't be surprised if Lindelof wouldn't agree that the way that cops shoot and treat Black Americans today, that's simply where this ends up if you don't actively change it.
Right, right. But I think just like the source material, the comic is quick to point out that all deviations in a timeline have their own sets of problems.
That's true. That's good. So who's doing the best acting on this show? because I think the acting's pretty good too.
It's really good. I think Regina King was pretty spectacular.
Mm-hmm.
And continues to be, but I mean, those first couple episodes, she really made it to me.
I'm a big fan of Tim Blake Nelson's portrayal of the detective.
This just, it feels like Delmar is wearing a mirror mask, you know? He was so good. It's been tough. I know he's done much work before and after, but he has been great. And he had an interesting line about race when he said she presented him with the KKK uniform that the chief was hiding. But right before that, she said, "Do you think he's a racist?" And notice in that scene that they're talking, she only asks questions to him or repeats information to him that he just said. She doesn't offer anything new. So they're feeling each other out very much. But she's kind of having to admit that she knew more than she let on in their earlier interactions. But she says, did you know he was a racist? And he says he was a white man in Oklahoma,
mm-hmm.
which he's also a white man in Oklahoma. Mm-hmm. What's he trying to say there?
Yeah, that's another loaded line. And I think he delivered it so well. He delivered it as a comment on himself as well as Judd Crawford's character, the Don right. Johnson character. Yeah, so a lot of questions still lingering in the air, obviously, and as well it should be, though not frustratingly.
No, not at all. I feel like we've got 5 episodes left. We're roughly at the center, dead center of this. So it'll be very interesting to see how it wraps up. I feel like this was episode 4 opened things up to the wider world.
Really quick, before we wrap, you said that you and Lee Baines were talking about this show. What kinds of things did you guys get into in your discussion?
I mean, a big part of it was that discussion we had about how the Tulsa Race Massacre is a thing that is not in a textbook anywhere. You know, I think you would be lucky. You would be fortunate to go through high school in American public education and have heard of it in that classroom setting, and just how many things were missing, you know.
Mm-hmm.
That was a big
that's
moment, because it's, you know, if you talk about being, a lot of his Lee stuff is based on, you know, labor movements that happened in the South that were participated in by both black and white, and how class warfare is really at the center of almost everything. And so, you know, I mean, that also plays right into that, the Tulsa Massacre. The whites were maybe okay with a black community until it started amassing money. Because money is power.
Right.
That was a big talking point.
So this show will probably be on the top 10 of a lot of people's list. If you made it this far and you haven't watched it, then I'm not sure what's up with you. But do listen to
us. You fell asleep. That's what happened.
Probably so. Yeah. So we've spoiled a lot. But there's a lot we haven't even spoiled. But we'll may come back to this one later. It's worth watching. It's worth talking about and thinking about. And it's amazing that it's, and I'm doing my air quotes again, it's amazing that it's just a comic book show, although it's not. So Lindelof has done an amazing job of taking something, and so did creator Alan Moore and Dave Gibbons. To use that.
They picked their moments, too. This would be a less potent show maybe during the Obama administration or even the George W. administration. Mm-hmm. But right now it feels a little bit like watching the news.
Yes, it does. A distorted, weird news with people running around with masks on. So, all right. Well, thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. What we'll do is we might return to this. We'll see how it goes. I hope you guys will stick around a little bit later on. We're going to be talking to Kevin Halbrook about some of the Egan's fiasco, and we'll get to that in a second. So thanks, Adam. I'll talk to you again soon.
Catch you later.
Okay, before we get into recent history news and stories about Egan's, I want to let you all know you can always check out the other two podcasts associated with our website, We have the Alabama Take. That's the original podcast that helped start all this podcast mess. Find that in a separate feed. And subscribe for host Corey Hanna's bi-monthly interviews with some of the great thinkers and artists in and around and associated with Alabama. Then there's Picks in a Parking Lot. That's brought to you by Trey Irby. His pod is almost exclusive to the website. Unless you kind of know where to look for it, you'll have to listen there on the website. But you can follow his podcast on Twitter for updates on when those are posted. It's a little sporadic, but they're pretty funny. It's Picks in a Parking Lot is the Twitter name, I think. Lastly, you can find the website just online for all the stuff I'm talking about here, all aggregated in one place for you. It's thealabamatake.com. Which will take us to kind of a nice segue into our next bit, because some of the stuff I'm talking about appeared in article form from me. So let's get into this next part. All right, I'm joined now by Kevin Halbrook. Kevin's the host of his own podcast, Where's the Line? I highly recommend it, always do. It's one of my favorites out there. He and co-host Samantha unspool a particularly disturbing true tale for you. Disturbing, and maybe it's gross, maybe it's scary, maybe it's both. I always enjoy them. I always learn something disturbing, usually. But you can find that at whereisthelion.net or any podcast hosting site such as Apple. Go seek that out. And welcome, Kevin. Welcome back. You're a frequent guest, and we appreciate it. We always enjoy having you on. Say hello to everyone.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Always enjoy talking to you.
And I've got you on in particular because of Egan's. But did you survive the epic weekend in Tuscaloosa?
I left town. I knew pretty early. I mean, when LSU comes to town, there's going to be fights everywhere anyway. And
Great response! I left town. I didn't see that coming.
You combine that, yeah. You combine just the average LSU weekend with Trump coming to town, and I was just. I'm not gonna be here for this. So I went and hung out with my mother.
Did you go to Nauvoo?
No, they live in Quinton now, and we actually went and hung out with some friends of theirs that have a fully stocked bar in the backyard. So I got game day drunk, but not in town.
Did you have a fire going? I picture a fire.
They had a lot of heaters sitting around out there.
Okay. Good. Sounds fun. So where's Quinton?
It is extreme south Walker County on the Walker County, Jefferson County border. They got a little house, on the river up there.
Okay. I never heard of that place. That's new to me.
Yeah, it's small.
Probably a wise choice. Before we go on, because that has a lot to do with the whole LSU stuff, has something to do with what we're getting into here. We're going to talk about Egan's, really. Let's just give a quick, recap, maybe. But I tell you what, I'll take even a step back from that. Let's give a quick plug for the podcast that you led that recapped some of the best Egan stories I've ever heard straight from the clientele's mouths. You want to tell folks where they can find that? And I think it's only staying up a few more months. Is that right?
When the podcast hosting rolls around again, I imagine I'm probably not going to pay to continue having it up there. But right now you can find it on our website, whereisthelion.net. There's a tab for Thick Smoke and Loud Music. You can find it on all of the podcasting services. Just search for Thick Smoke and Loud Music and it'll be there. But yeah, that was in the week before Egan's changed hands. We went in there with a table and some microphones and recorded 42 patrons relating some of the dirtiest and most illegal stories you've ever heard.
Yeah, and not only I think you were gracious enough to share it on the Alabama Take so that you can find it there. Yeah. But it's probably best to find it on a podcast aggregator and just listen.
Yeah, if you look for it on the Alabama Take, though, there's an article that goes along with all of the episodes.
Ah, there you go.
Yep.
There you go. That works. So we can, there were like four or five episodes, I think, right?
Yeah, well, there were three.
Okay, three.
Yep.
But yes, they make for some seriously comedic, even touching listening, actually, as points.
Yeah, and one of the things that I forget to mention a lot when I talk about that is that we got permission from a lot of bands that actually played in Egan's. Mm. So in between the stories, you hear little short clips of music of bands that actually played in that bar back when it would let them play there.
Yeah. No, yeah. That's a wink on what's coming down the line in this conversation. I'm not going to cover the whole history of vegans. Number one, that's a lot. And number two, I don't know it. But I'd venture to say it's one of the oldest bars in Tuscaloosa at the now.
Yeah, I think Galette's is the only bar that's older than Egan's that's still standing and still has the same name.
Okay. Yeah, Egan's is found on University Boulevard just across from another Tuscaloosa staple, the Houndstooth. And that's a pretty old bar. And they went through a renovation, but it's been around.
Yeah, it's been there for a while.
I came onto Egan's scene, you could say, around 2000, but then it really became a part of my life. The place and the people really became a part of my life when I started playing music. So I'd say about 2003 or so. Mm-hmm. But this isn't about me at all. I wanted to just say that my knowledge of it is somewhat limited, but I do feel like I have a fairly established relationship with Egan's and its patrons, especially during that era. It was then owned by Bob Weatherly, ran by Ashley Hill. Bob had owned it since 1981, just for reference sake. So, and how would you describe it, just in general, that time period when you and I were hanging out there and got to know one another?
It was one of the rare inclusive places in Alabama. I mean, you could go in there and hang out with drag queens and gay people and straight people and Harley bikers and school teachers, Vietnam vets, and everybody got along pretty well. It was... you were welcome in there as long as you were welcoming to everyone else. The music was good.
Yeah, very true. Weird, odd. You're going to see something a little different on some nights, and you're going to see some fantastic stuff on some nights, and a combination of both.
Yeah, and if you know, on the rare occasion that you couldn't find somebody to talk to in there, you could always wander around and look at the pictures on the walls from, you know, going back to the 70s and, you know... See people who had, you know, passed on, or, you know, people what they looked like 20 years ago who were still hanging out in there.
Yeah. There was a great picture of Jerry Lee Lewis on there that somebody had taken from an audience standpoint, I think.
Yeah.
I always remember that one. So let's fast forward to May 2018. Bob Weatherly wanted to retire, from what I understand. He had already sold the property itself to Philip Weaver a few months before, but a guy named Craig Williams began leasing Egan's, that property, in May, that year we're talking about, last year. Then this dude named Mike took over its operations, kind of the same way that Bob had been taking over, had been running the operations in the last few months, sort of as a person who controlled the lease.
Yeah.
Am I right about that?
Yeah, he was... Bob was going to sell that to Craig Williams, and something happened. I never found out exactly what it was, but that deal fell through. And when it did, Mike McWhirter jumped on it and bought the bar.
There we go. And what do you know about Mike? Had he been in Egan's lot? Because I still don't know him.
I had seen him in there a time or two. When they were when he was buying the place, and there were a lot of arguments over whether or not this was going to be a good move for Egan's. He kept posting this one picture of him in the bar like years ago, proving he had been there before. But I don't think he was a regular, but he did come in from time to time.
The implication being that's the only picture he had.
Yeah, well, I'm sure there's other pictures, but
yeah. So we're kind of building up to this post that they made on Facebook, I think Thursday, this last Thursday. So if you haven't followed any of the news lately, that's probably good, but here it is. Donald Trump decided to stroke his ego and come to town for the big LSU-Alabama game because he knew that probably 85% of the people in there would jerk off to his presence. And the next thing we know, I'm presumably Mike. You might know more about that than I. Post on Facebook. Let me just read it word for word. I don't, because it's pretty short. I don't want to misquote it. He wrote, assuming it's him, "The president of the United States is always welcome at Egan's Bar. Republican, Democrat, white, black, male, female. We don't care. We respect you because you are the leader of our country." And that caught fire. He caught some hell over it, apparently. Probably a lot of dislikes or angry buttons pushed on Facebook. And he posted a reply just underneath it that basically was pretty sarcastic in its tone and not very funny, just saying, go back and read my post. Maybe I should read it, but anyway, you can go read it for yourselves. And that's where we are today. And I ended up writing about it. Trey Irby ended up writing about it for the Alabama Take. You had thoughts about it, and that's why you're here. So what'd you make of it all?
Yeah, well, that post is not in itself that bad. I think that no. was just kind of the straw that broke the camel's back for a lot of people. You know, when Mike bought that bar, you know, we were doing the Thick Smoke and Loud Music, interviewing the people. Essentially, maybe even every single person that we talked to said that they hope it doesn't change too much. And everybody talked about all the pictures on the wall and how much it meant to them to have the Egan's class photos, which is when all the regulars would get their pictures taken once a year and those would go up on the wall. Mm-hmm. And then when Mike bought the place, he fired everybody except for one person who worked there.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. As soon as Mike bought the place, you know, all of those old bartenders that we loved lost their jobs. He kept one person who he later accused of stealing and fired that person. And he, you know, before the bar reopened, he took all of these pictures off the wall. I think there was a picture of opening day. You know, all of these class photos of the people who had been coming there for years, just took all of that off the wall, piled it up in the floor, and sold it all for $10 a pop. So that's all scattered to the wind, you know.
Yeah.
Never to be returned.
A lot of it actually is in Brian Olio's garage.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, I've been over there.
If you want to go see it, contact Brian. He seems pretty willing to let people come look at it. But it's certainly a capture of a time period.
Yeah. And, you know, and all through this, I'm not sure what Mike McWhirter's business model is. I feel like he was trying. I don't think that Mike ever really liked a lot of the weird type people that Egan's was known to have. I think that he wanted that to be more of a frat guy kind of bar. So it feels like he was actively trying to push a lot of people out, but at the same time, he wasn't getting the patronage of that new group of people that he seemed like he wanted. So I don't know what his business model is or if he has one. If he does have one, it is absolutely baffling to me what it might be.
It could very well be drive old people out and get new people in, right?
Yeah, but you would think that he'd want to have some of those new people coming in before he drove all of the old people out. I went there for the Arkansas home game.
Okay.
I will say that Egan's is now the only place on the strip where you can find a seat at the bar right in the middle of a home game.
Shit.
Yeah, nope.
And that was never the case.
Yeah, and you know, and he just keeps doing these things, you know, selling the pictures off the walls, firing people. And every time he does something like that, a few more people and a few more people leave. And I think with that post about Donald Trump, which, mm-hmm. you know, again, to me, that did not strike me as that bad, you know. But also, Egan's has traditionally been that last inclusive place in town, that last place for the weird people and, you know, weird for Alabama to mm-hmm. go. And, you know, to say something like Trump is welcome there, even the way he said it, you know, it wasn't explicitly that he's a big Trump supporter, but it's still that's the traditional crowd at Egan's. That's not something that you want to put out there in front of them.
What struck me about the initial post, which I didn't have a ton of problem with, I read it and kind of rolled my eyes,
yeah.
but I just thought the old Egan's would have never posted that.
Yeah, they just wouldn't have said anything.
They would have never made a claim. Yeah, they would have, yeah. And if it would have been Barack Obama coming to Tuscaloosa for game day, I just don't feel like they would have posted anything.
Yeah, no. And, you know, a smart business owner will not take part in politics. I mean, you've got the country split 50-50, you know. Every election is really close between Democrats and Republicans, and Alabama is not split 50-50, but this is a college town with a more liberal populous than the rest of Alabama. So yeah, if you own a business, just don't engage in politics, really.
It really boils down to a couple of things, and it is very political, which taking it down our podcast avoid. Well, we don't avoid, but we don't. It's just not. We're pop culture podcast, but it boils down to Trump and his policies and his actions. Whatever his policies are, they're few and far between. It seems like, other than building a wall and tax breaks for the rich, but. That's simplifying. I shouldn't do that. But anyway, it boils down to Trump's policies and actions, and it boils down to the patrons of Egan's beliefs, and they do not coincide. They do not mesh. So posting that would have been a clear ignorance on the part of whoever did it, on who his clientele would be at Egan's.
It was Mike that did it. I have no doubt in my mind. You can read it and just hear his voice saying that. But yeah, I mean, if you've got a clientele where you have, you know, quite a few gay people, you know that you have a lot of liberal people coming in there. You know, I mean, there's a lot of conservative people that go in there too. But when you know that you've got that many people that are really, you know, for good reasons, very far on the left politically. You just don't say that Donald Trump is welcome at this bar that you have, which is known to be patronaged by quite a few gay people.
And I would venture to say, I don't want to put words in anyone's mouth, but I'm going to take a stab at guessing that the conservative people who have frequented Egan's are the classic Republican, not the Donald Trump Republican.
Yeah, more center.
Maybe.
More centered
just your old Reagan, maybe even your Bush kind of Republican, and not so much your white supremacist.
Yeah, Republican. Not the alt-right. Uh-huh. Although now, since Mike has taken over, I have gone in there and had someone sit down next to me and say Heil Hitler to me.
Jesus, why?
I know.
What prompted that?
Well, you know, and I looked at the guy and. And I just asked him, I said, you know, sometimes I sarcastically say things just to sarcastically be an asshole. Is that what you're doing? And it was not. It was this little alt-right kid. I ended up running him out of there.
Good for you.
Yeah. I have a... Well, and there was another time that I went in there and Prince started playing, which everybody... How do you not love Prince?
I'm not the biggest fan, but I can jam him in a crowd, sure.
Well, yeah, I mean, even if you're not a fan, this guy said that Prince comes on the radio, and this guy starts yelling that they need to turn that off because Prince is lighting the loafers.
That's stupid.
Yeah, so that's the kind of thing you can hear in the Mike McWhirter's Egan's. Both of those people, though, I've got a pretty good way of dealing with this now, which is hate shots. Because I can drink pretty heavily, so I just buy these people shots until they start throwing up.
Oh, well, it's a costly method, but if effective, I suppose.
Well, it's not that costly, really. And actually, the guy that said that Prince was lighting the loafers, I sat down next to him and bought a couple of shots, and I got myself a Jack Daniels, and I got him a purple Hooter. Said okay. I wanted to give him something he could handle.
I gotcha. Yeah, fitting. So give me a what's it like in there? You're kind of touching on it. I haven't been since. Okay, full disclosure, I honestly probably had quit going to Egan's. Even though I lived in Tuscaloosa for quite a while, I kind of had phased it out. The smoking had become pretty bad for me. And it had for a lot of people.
Well, it always was. Yeah.
It was horrible, yeah. But so I haven't, and I had since moved away. But do tell me what it's like in there now.
Well, I've got nothing against the new bartenders. They're very nice. There's a couple of them that I really, really like. But they're not dive bar bartenders, you know. They're younger people. The girls are cute. They wear little tight tank tops and things. It's not a... When you go into a dive bar, you need a grizzly old man in there just, you know, being mean to you. That's just part of being a dive bar.
Ashley Hill.
Yeah, you need Ashley Hill if you want to have a dive bar. Yeah. those pictures that were on the wall, a big portion of that area is now covered with a gigantic photograph of Bryant-Denny Stadium, just in case you miss seeing it, because you can actually see it from outside the bar. Yeah, we had taken it to calling it the sports bar across from the Houndstooth.
And for those that don't know, that's pretty funny, because the Houndstooth is a sports bar.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And they do a better job at being a sports bar, really. I mean,
oh, yeah.
Egan's just doesn't seem like it knows what it wants to be.
I had a bigger problem with the reply that came under it, which was basically saying it was kind of cruel in its tone. And it was saying, look, having the president here would be cool, no matter who the president is. It's all about money. And we know it's all about money when it comes to a business, and it should be, but therefore you don't have to say it.
Yeah, I would be a terrible businessman. Yeah,
I think you've proven that. You've given away all your mugs from your website.
Yeah. I bought a bunch of mugs to try to give away to sell for our show, and just ended up giving them all away to people who said they didn't have enough money for one, and cost myself about $400. But
but good for you, looking out for the working man.
I feel like there needs to be a balance between community and art and profit.
Mm-hmm. And it seemed like Egan's was that place that would happen.
Yeah.
Bands would get paid the lowest amount that you could make in any bar in Tuscaloosa, but at the same time, your band was almost guaranteed a spot to play if you wanted to.
Yeah.
You got your exposure. There was a payoff. You got your exposure. You got low pay, but they didn't limit the amount of drinks you got either.
Yeah, yeah, you could drink for free all night.
All domestics. Night.
Yep.
In fact, they would force drinks on you if you weren't.
Yeah, yeah.
I can clearly remember playing many a show, and they would bring me a drink, and I would be mid-singing, and they'd pour the drink down my throat.
Yeah, yeah, especially when I was playing there, because apparently it was really funny to get me with a microphone and get me shit-faced.
It was. Just for reference, it was. So, would you want to comment on, and you feel free to not to, it's totally up to you, about, there was also an element to this that happened on Halloween.
Mm-hmm.
You want to, is that in your realm to comment on, or is that something you'd like
to
move?
Yeah, that was, you know, I should not have gone back there long ago, but, you know, I did keep going back for a while because there's a lot of people that I know who were still going there. There's a lot less of them now, but, and, you know, and I love those people. And anybody that's mm-hmm. still going there now that I'm friends with, like, I don't blame them. You know, it's comfortable to go and sit in the same place that you've been sitting for years.
Sure.
I'm not going to be back in there because of what happened on Halloween, which was I play the drums with DC Moon mm-hmm. and, he's pretty much a Halloween. I mean, he's a fixture in Tuscaloosa anyway, but particularly on Halloween because all these songs are sci-fi and horror movie based punk rock. Mm-hmm. He had booked a show for Halloween at Egan's and was going to have kind of a reunion of this band Mary Talasaur that they did. So had some people coming in town to play in that band, and then we were going to follow that. DC had bought all of this recording stuff. He wanted to record the show. He spent all this money on these giant posters. Mm-hmm. And then 3 days before the show, Mike McWhirter texts DC Moon, gonna have to cancel Halloween.
Okay.
And that's all he said.
and you guys know why, don't you?
Yeah, well, you know, DC started picking at him about that, you know, like, what happened. And McWhirter said that he didn't feel comfortable with letting a band play there whose drummer had started back talking bad about him and his business.
And that's you.
And that's me.
Yeah. Yeah, and you've talked about online how you don't blame him for that, but there's a problem in that. It was 3 days before, and DC had bought all this recording equipment and spent money to promote the show.
Yeah, exactly. And I don't know where he got the starting back thing, because, you know, he said, I don't feel comfortable, you know, now that your drummer has started back talking bad about me and my business, to which my reply was, I didn't start back anything. I've been calling Mike McWhirter a dick for a year straight. There was no starting back on my point. This is how you've been consistently unhappy with that man for a very long time. But he knew that I was in the band. We had played there before. It's not like he found out that I was in the band and then canceled the show. He knew the entire time. And I think that I kind of think what he had hoped would happen was that since DC had this other band playing, that they would just kick me out for the night and then just play the whole night with that other band. But that's not what happened. The whole thing just fell apart. So they didn't have any band play that night. And it looks like not many people showed up.
And that bothered a lot of people, not just DC and his band members, but friends of his and people who would have come out to see the show, it seems like.
Yeah, I mean, you know, and me, whatever. Like, I'm outspoken to the point that a lot of people think I'm an asshole, and I don't blame them. But everybody likes DC. I mean, even if you don't like the music, DC's a nice guy. You know?
He is. He's real nice.
He spends so much money donating to like animal welfare programs and things. And that really, really upset DC. And I honestly felt really bad. You know, I don't feel like it was my fault. If Mike didn't want me playing there, he should have let us know a long time before so we could have scheduled something else.
Yeah.
But I totally agree. Feel really bad about the fact that what caused us to not play that night was something that it was mine and Mike's beef, and that kind of ruined DC's Halloween.
It did. And ruined a few others. Ruined a few others than DC. And he is a good guy. So shout out to DC. Go check out his music, DC Moon. You can find him online pretty easily. He is a nice guy. All my encounters with him have been very, very kind. And I think it boils down to me is that an establishment should want to make money, of course, but at what cost? And I think that's the thesis of my entire set of thoughts today and from my recent article online. Well, it's a shame. So you have any final thoughts about Egan's?
Yeah, I mean, you know, you were saying a business has to make money. And, you know, the purpose is to make more money. But there's no way that Egan's is making more money. They're just continually running more and more people out. I mean, you know, like I said, on game day, you can get a seat at the bar. If you look at the pictures on Halloween night, they tried to cleverly take them, but they were, you know, pictures of like three people, two of which would be the bartender. Taken from a low angle so that you couldn't see that there was nobody behind them, that kind of thing. So, yeah, I don't know. I don't feel like Egan's is going to last very much longer.
And that's a prime piece of real estate in Tuscaloosa.
Yeah. You know, I wish somebody that was understood the spirit of the place would buy it. But, you know, at this point, yeah, who knows? I don't know. I'm almost kind of tired of talking about it now.
Yeah,
this drama's been going on for a long time, so I was actually telling somebody yesterday that I'm going to talk to you about it today, and then I am just done.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad you did, because it offered a little insight for me that I had kind of followed from a distance. So, yeah, that'll be it, I think. Well, I appreciate you coming on, Kevin. That's very insightful. We'll have you on again soon, I'm sure, but
yeah, thanks for having me. I'm always glad to do it.
Yeah, very happy to have you. So we'll go ahead and wrap up here. That is it for this episode of our Pop Culture Bullshit. We hope you enjoyed it enough to join us again down the line, because we'll be back in 2 weeks. We're going to take on The Mandalorian, that's going to appear on Disney Plus, and The Irishman from Netflix. We actually know ahead of time what we're doing in a couple of weeks, so you can watch those and come back, and we'll get spoiled on those if you want to listen. If you have ideas for us for future episodes, drop us a line at thealabamatake.com or thealabamatake@gmail. You can find us on any social media outlet except Snapchat and TikTok, because no one wants that shit. In the meantime, Find us on Apple Podcasts or wherever. Subscribe to us, rate us, review us, send us money, whatever you want. We'll see you in 2 weeks.